You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is CJ Box. Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories today. We've got a fantastic show lined up for you. Before we get into that, I'd like to tell you about some sponsors today. Crystal Pico Watanabe at Pico's House. The Pico's House website now has a new look. She's got a team of 8 people who help provide services to fiction authors. And she has a full slate of services that now include beta reading. She's got 4 beta readers now. So if you're looking for beta reading services, she can definitely take on your project. Manuscript critique, developmental editing, line editing, copy editing, and proofreading. Authors can also inquire about putting their books in her Book Lovers Box, which is a monthly digital subscription box with a different theme each month. It's free to authors for a limited time. Be sure to check out Crystal and her whole team at Pico's House. That's PikkosHouse.com. Thanks, Crystal, for sponsoring the show. While Cape and Spandex movies are breaking box office records, comic book commentator and influencer Ed Gosney doesn't want us to forget the roots of these marvelous wonders. His blog, Cool Comics in My Collection, at edgosney.com, covers the gamut of four-color entertainment, from contemporary comic books to comics made for kids to bargain bin gold to classics that will transport you back in time. Comic books are a perfect blend of art and story, and Cool Comics captures the essence of what these funny books mean to us in a personal way. And make sure to join the Cool Comics in My Collection Facebook group, where members can interact, show off their prized comics, and have opportunities to win, you guessed it, Cool Comics. Published weekly, Cool Comics in My Collection aims to bring you a smile and reminds us why comic books are fun. Be sure to visit edgosney.com today. Speaking of superheroes and comics, my friend Patricia Gillum has a fantastic series called The Heroes of Corvus. It begins with book 1, a flight between a second-generation superhero named Red Bolt and a villain-for-hire named Icarus goes terribly wrong, resulting in the drowning deaths of 3 innocent civilians and orphaning a 6-year-old boy. Racked with guilt, Red Bolt visits Cameron Wilson at the hospital every night and won't leave the boy's side until he falls asleep. Befriended by a night shift nurse, the man in costume begins to disclose what really happened after the fight and why he feels the deaths of Cameron's parents and sister fall on his actions. A superhero didn't survive that night, and Cameron and the rest of the city aren't out of danger. This is such a phenomenal story. She has released up to part 4 now, and I cannot wait for part 5 to come out. If you're looking for a great adventure read that's on the cutting edge of what is in today's entertainment, The Heroes of Corvus is the series for you by Patricia Gillum. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com to subscribe to the show. We're on just about every platform you can imagine. Now stay tuned for our show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have CJ Box back on the show with us today. He has a brand new book called The Bitter Roots, and it's the latest in the Cassie Duell series. You might remember CJ was with us just a few months ago talking about Wolfpack, the latest in his other series, and we'll talk all about that in just a minute. But welcome back to the show, CJ.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
I'm excited to have you. This new book, The Bitter Roots, is amazing. It's is it book number 5 in the Cassie Duell series?
Well, it is, but I never really planned to write a second series.
Right.
It just kind of it kind of came just sort of organically that Cassie Duell is actually introduced in a book called The Highway.
Right.
Creepiest book I've ever written, and then she's been in. Actually, this is the 4th one.
That right. That's what I meant to say.
And now I guess I am writing another series, and it even says in the book a Cassie Duell novel. So there you go.
And you're like, dang it, I didn't mean to do that.
Well, it just kind of happened. It's a funny thing to write.
Well, you know, it has to be because the The tone of the Cassie Duell books is so different from your Joe Pickett books, and for a lot of different reasons other than just the surface reasons of kind of the scenery is different. What was it that brought Cassie to you, and at what point did you realize that, you know, I think this might have legs that could be more than what I first anticipated?
Well, you know, I'm a very meticulous outliner and planner of each novel. And when I was writing The Highway, the protagonist is Cody Hoyt, who becomes Cassie's mentor in that book. They both work for the Lewis and Clark County Sheriff's Department in Montana. And the book is primarily about Cody and his investigation with Cassie's assistance. But I really found myself kind of unplanned, really liking writing the Cassie character. She's a single mom. Her husband was killed in the military in Afghanistan. She's got a son at home. She's a little overweight. She's no action hero. But it was fun to write from her perspective. And when the book was done, what I found was that, you know, I've got my wife and my three daughters and my female agent and my female editor all really like Cassie Duell a lot, and I like writing the character. So she showed up in another book and then another book, and they're a little darker than the Joe Pickett books, I think, take place outside of Wyoming, but it's fun to write her character, and the reception for her as a character has been great.
Well, what's interesting to me about Cassie and her stories is they are darker, like you said, and how do you get into that mindset to and the family dynamics are different. There's a lot of things that make them darker. Are there certain exercises that you go through when it's time to switch from Pickett over to Cassie?
You know, I wouldn't say there's any kind of exercise, and I think that's. It all comes down to point of view, whether it's Cassie or Joe Pickett or a bad guy or a serial killer truck driver. Once the point of view becomes clear, I can kind of write from that point of view. Once I understand their motivation and their mindset, I find that it comes fairly easily to stay in that lane.
You've had a busy year, CJ. You know, Wolfpack came out just back in the spring, and now you're here with The Bitter Roots. How do you manage such a hectic schedule?
Well, you know, my pace is kind of a book and a half a year, which means last year I completed both of those novels, and they were out this year. This year I'm doing just the Joe Pickett novel. So it's I don't know how to answer that other than I just go to work every day, like it. It's not as taxing as it might sound. I go and do my certain word count every day and then move on from there, and that kind of results in a number of books.
Yeah. Well, with I know you're a dedicated outliner. Do you have a certain schedule that you adhere to, and do you ever take months or weeks off during the year where you're not, living in Pickett or Duell world?
Well, there, you know, really, I mean, we take a vacation, and I live in a place where I can go fishing and quite often. I'm a fly fisherman, and we've got a river within sight, and so I get out and about, but. You know, really the only time where I'm not actively writing is once I have finished a book or finished the first draft of it, and it goes to all my first readers, including my wife first. So while they're reading it, I kind of catch up on things and get some things done and that I wouldn't normally do, because I don't want to start writing a new book right then. I kind of wait to get the feedback, and then I go back to the manuscript, and then it goes off to New York.
Gotcha. In the new book, The Bitter Roots, Cassie has had some changes in her life, and she's opened a business of her own, thinking that this is going to bring some stability to her life and maybe some normalcy for she and her son. What's the growth decisions? What are they like in writing her and trying to see what the logical steps that she would take, you know, to try to move her life along, and then how fun is it to knock all those things down?
Well, in the previous book, she was in law enforcement, two different sheriff's departments, chief investigator, and in both there was a lot of inter-office and political turmoil going on. And although she always tries to do the right thing and play by the rules kind of thing, she was often thwarted and sometimes undermined. And she just the last book ended with her arriving into her native Montana and meeting a lawyer who suggested that maybe, you know, Cassie could pick up some work if she went another direction. So in this book, she's opened her own private investigative firm. I've always wanted to write a PI novel, always. And one of the things I discovered, as she does, as I'm writing it, is that she finds out she doesn't have the kind of authority that she used to. She can't flash a badge and ask, you know, demand answers. Especially, she finds herself on the other side of a little sheriff's department that is stonewalling her and pushing back, and there's not a lot she can do about it.
which is a whole different power dynamic than she's used to, and makes her have to use her skill and cunning, and you get to flex those PI muscles. That has to be fulfilling as a writer, you know, because the Pickett series is a completely different dynamic, and as a game warden, he comes with a whole different skill set, and just trouble finds him. But that has to be so much fun for someone who, you know, obviously kind of cut your teeth on those kinds of books.
Right, and it is. I mean, I think some of the first time I ever realized I was reading, I guess, crime fiction and crime novels was Raymond Chandler. And then, you know, on from there. But yeah, it is a different dynamic. It doesn't have, for example, when she's doing the investigation, she doesn't have, you know, she can talk to people off the record and get a lot of information and pursue other angles that in law enforcement she couldn't really legally, ethically get into. So it gives her a little bit more opening, but at the same time, it's more limited.
Right. Cassie also finds herself doing some work that she never thought she would be involved with. And tell us about her being involved with defense, which is completely turned around from what she's used to.
Right. It goes against, just cuts against her grain, because in enforcement, she didn't think very much of private investigators and certainly didn't think much of defense attorneys. But in this case, she's hired by, mainly out of an obligation that she has, hired by a female defense attorney in Bozeman, whose client is the oldest son of a kind of dynastic ranch family who has been accused of sexually assaulting his 15-year-old niece. So it's really kind of a nasty crime, and the last thing Cassie wants to do is be involved with his defense, because she doesn't think he's innocent. So she takes the case on the contingency that her job is to simply confirm that the sheriff's investigation and that the prosecution is wholly on the up and up and clean, so that the attorney can convince the oldest son to take a plea as opposed to go to trial. But when she goes to the little county, Loxa County, Montana, in northwestern Montana, Cassie immediately encounters a lot of pushback from the sheriff's department and real active resistance from the family itself. And, you know, to her chagrin, she realizes there's a lot much, much more to the case.
There's such interesting power dynamics in this book, and you mentioned the ranch families and the kind of old power structure that's there. There's a great TV show that's on right now, Yellowstone, with Kevin Costner, and you kind of get this feel for this generational thing within ranches and ranch families and people that have been on the land for so long. And with that, a lot of times comes these feelings of entitlement and, you know, that you run the town. You know, you're a major contributor to it, therefore you should be, you know, kind of owner of everything. How How much fun was that to play with? And are those things a reality out west?
They are. I think it's something I've been fascinated with for a long, long time. Before I ever wrote a novel, I was a newspaper reporter in a small town in Wyoming. And some of the bigger stories I covered were ranch families. And it's usually not necessarily the sons and daughters of the founders, but the grandchildren or great-grandchildren who, for one reason or another, you know, go to war either for control of the ranch or because one of them wants to sell the ranch or they want things to do differently. And in this case, it's the Kleinsasser family of Lhoxa, Montana. And they are about as dysfunctional as you can get. I've been writing about big ranch families for quite a long time, well before Yellowstone was ever on the air. It does continue, and it's fascinating. It's not anything that's isolated simply to the West or ranches. It's any kind of multi-generational business enterprise that can sometimes go really wrong.
Well, it's just interesting when you're talking about ranches, because you're talking about these big pieces of land and how this place affects the people that surround it. And it's just a really interesting power dynamic that even though you may be talking about a New York City family, the money and power means something different there because it's not attached to a place necessarily.
Right. Yep. Good point.
Yeah. When you start thinking about Cassie or thinking about a new Joe Pickett book, what are the first things you start going through when thinking about what you're going to put these characters through in the story?
I always start with the issues or controversies. I'll take maybe the Joe Pickett one first. Is that I generally come up with two or three big kind of things that people are talking about, whether they're environmental, energy-based, resource-based, culture-based, and then do the research on those particular topics, and then try to, in a sense, figure out a way to pull a reader through these big topics in what I hope is a page-turning way. And I enjoy the research part of it a lot, like going to the places where the book's going to take place or doing the things that happen in the book so that I can write about them realistically. And the current book, for example, the Joe Pickett book I'm writing right now, I noticed I live in the West, and that so many of the hunters and sportsmen in the area have really gotten into, you know, super long-range shooting, because you can now buy rifles that straight out of the box with a very high-tech scope can hit targets over 1,000 yards away and out of eyesight. And that has changed the whole dynamics of hunting and target shooting. And so I wanted to get into that. I was interested. I'm not a long-distance shooter, but I went and learned about it and went to the Gunworks facility in Cody where they're making some of these rifles. Learned a lot about it so I can incorporate that into the next book. So that's kind of how I start, with the topics and the issues, and then go to the outline and the plot.
That's things like that can really be hot button issues, because they, you start dealing with matters of morality. You know, if you're shooting something that you can't see anymore, is that still hunting? Those have to be fun things to start kind of dissecting and maybe thinking about how you feel about them as a person, and then, you know, how are my characters going to feel about these? And have you ever had an issue that you had an opinion about or maybe, you know, felt a certain way, but through the research and then through the writing with your characters, maybe changed the way you thought about something?
It has happened, yes. I would say I've written a couple books that pertain to wind energy and wind and turbines that are going up. The largest wind farm in the world is going in not too far from where I live, 1,000 wind turbines. And all of the power is dedicated to Southern California, because they have mandates, they need it, they have to have it. But as I wrote about that, and I even went up to the top of a turbine to see how they work, I was fascinated to find out that the electrical grid in this area, at least, often turns that energy off because they don't need it. So those turbines are just spinning and not producing any energy, although the owners of them have certain tax incentives and real advantages. So it's not as cost-effective as I thought it would be, and I realized a lot of it has to do with taxes and incentives and not energy.
That has to be frustrating, to watch that whole process and realizing that there's so much politics behind it.
It's politics, almost religion behind it.
Right.
Where
right.
Some people can look at a gigantic wind farm, you know, as far as you can see, and see a thing of beauty because it's not fossil fuel, and others just look at all these turbines as far as you can see and think it's a blight against the landscape.
Right. Well, and also how's that affecting bird migrations and all of those things you have to take into account as well.
Right. Kills a lot of bats, too. Wind farms kill a lot of bats.
Well, and in the South where I'm from, we depend on bats to kill mosquitoes, so that would be bad.
Yes.
Yeah. So, oh, man. When you first start thinking about the controversies and topics that you want to dig into, and you start the research phase, how long does that usually last before the actual pre-writing, but before you have the elements to start putting an outline together?
It varies depending on the topic, because some I'm very familiar with and don't need as much background material. But others, others might require, you know, maybe the first month of kind of, you know, researching, talking to people on both sides of the issue, doing a lot of reading, traveling sometimes to go to the spot or go do the thing, and then from then on I can go on. But rarely does it take more than that.
Gotcha. Your last book, Wolfpack, debuted at number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list. This is, how many books in are you now? 20 or better?
26.
26. That is an amazing body of work that you put together. At what point in writing this series did you realize that... you know, I think I'm going to make it, you know, and it's a wonderful thing to debut in the New York Times and all of that stuff. But it's another thing to realize that you've built an audience and that people are buying the books and they are depending that you're going to keep writing them and that this is a sustainable thing.
I think with the Joe Pickett series, I think it was probably the third book, the one called Winter Kill. I remember writing it. I was still working full time and, did for quite a long time after that, but it was while writing that book, the third one, that I realized I feel more like a writer than a business person right now. This thing is coming together. I'm starting to get it figured out. The books, each book sold, you know, outsold the previous one, which luckily I can say is still the case. But I think it was that one that where I really felt like I changed careers.
That's so cool. It's a different thing when you're working full time and you have a schedule that you need to keep, and you know you're always working on a project. Do you ever have to take time to refill your creative tank? And what do you do to stay creative and not just feel you know like I'm writer monkey and I have to show up every day and churn out words?
Well, you know, I don't know if you ever really take time off completely. I think if you're a writer, you're just kind of a predator. Everything you do, it may turn out to be material someday. I tend to go, I go fishing a lot. I'm a fly fisherman, a hunter. I do a lot of outdoors things. But even while I'm doing all of that, I'm always thinking, I bet I could use this somewhere. Or what an interesting thing, and I'll make a note. But it's pleasurable. It's not like I always feel like I'm on the clock. It's just I enjoy that.
Gotcha. Do you have you played with any other characters that you might think could be a new protagonist?
I'm not at this point. I'm not looking for a new protagonist. I have so many characters across the novels I've already written that I'm not actively looking for another one, because I think there's a lot of stories to be told just within the kind of universe of characters and people and locations that I've already established.
In the new book, by moving Cassie to a private investigator and not working in law enforcement, do you see more stories hatching for her?
I do. I don't have one yet, but I'm confident that I will, because I haven't ever really struggled for, oh my goodness, I need an idea, I don't have one. They tend to come kind of naturally, and I just let them, and rather than forcing it. And, you know, for example, I've kind of got ideas for the next Joe Pickett book, but I never really start thinking about the next one till the last one is written, because I think if you know what the next one is going to be completely, you tend to hold things back. And I think the reader can sense that you're holding it back. So I just try to put everything into every book and then figure out the next step.
Do you have a kind of an overarching outline of the series, or do you have a point in mind that you're writing toward?
No, in both cases. I don't have a big strategy out there for the future. In both cases, especially with the Joe Pickett books, they occur in real time. So Joe Pickett was, I think, 34 in the first book, and now he's 50. And, you know, I time that, I plant that out and figure out, is this new book going to be a year after the last one, or 6 months, or immediately afterward? So there'll be a time when it doesn't make sense to, continue this guy's career, and I'll probably be ready to stop about then, too.
What's one of your favorite things about writing about Montana?
I like going there. I'm very familiar with the state. Although I'm from Wyoming, I've had a lot of Montana relatives. And before the books took off, I was involved in actually promoting Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, and South Dakota as tourism destinations in Europe. We had a company with offices over there. So I've spent a lot of time in Montana. It's twice the size of Wyoming with twice the population, but very similar in that the mindset, the people, and the landscapes and the rivers. So it's big and it's isolated and very strangely diverse for a big place with not many people.
When you come home and start writing about Wyoming, are they, of course they're different places, but what are things that are different about Wyoming and Montana that come out in your writing?
I think Montana's history is a little more contentious than Wyoming's, in that there were a lot of early mining days of Anaconda coal and copper and stuff. There was a lot of union violence. It was it comes from a little different mindset of even though those industries hardly exist there now, there still is a little bit of still a little more contention within the state than I think there is in Wyoming. But Wyoming has its issues too. But they're not exactly, the same states, and I don't think any of them are. And the states are so huge that Montana is about the size of Germany. Wyoming's about the size of France, so they're big, and from one corner to the next, things really change.
You talked about aging Joe Pickett in real time, and I think we've talked before about the things that come along with that, and having to keep his character honest. Because you can't back up time and, allow him to keep doing some of the things that he did earlier, because, you just get older and you have to stay honest with the character in that way. Do you have the same feelings about Cassie?
I do. You know, she's in her late 30s, early 40s. You know, she's not, like I said, mentioned earlier, she's not an action hero to begin with. She's a little more cerebral, but and she tends to use the technology a little bit more. She's in settings where she can do it more. So she's developing too, but she's a brand new private detective, and I think she's got a lot to learn.
Yeah. Well, so much fun, this new book. And the what is it about it that makes Cassie's stories darker, do you think? Is it just the things that she has at stake? What is it that makes her stories darker?
A lot of it is simply the antagonist she's up against. You know, in the first book, The Highway, the person she's up against, you know, a very crooked Montana State trooper, highway patrolman, and a serial killer truck driver. They're nasty people, and it's really kind of, you know, heinous crimes, whereas Joe Pickett's tends to be a little bit more resource-based. You know, certainly things happen, but they're not quite as dark as that. And I think that just sort of lingers over her life. And just like in the current book, The Bitterroot, she's still sort of haunted by her long quest to get the truck driver, as well as, you know, the fate of Cody Hoyt, her mentor, in a previous book.
Well, the new book is The Bitterroot. It's out everywhere now. CJ, you know, each time you keep ratcheting up the tension and the story, and you make us love these characters even more than we thought we could. The book's out, available everywhere now in hardcover, audiobook, Kindle edition. CJ, thank you so much for taking time to come back on the show today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning in to the Author Stories Podcast. Be sure to subscribe at hankgarner.com or on your favorite podcasting app. Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
Hello, young one. What ghoulish tale of horror shall we explore tonight? Shall we watch The Creep Show? The Nightmare on Elm Street? Child of the Night, give me your answer.
Which one would Mom kill us for watching? Said Buddy. Dad grinned and his eyes grew wide.
Which do you think, Child of the Jackal?
The Omen!
And we might have time for Omen too, if we hurry. She'll be home by 11.
I'll be back. Buddy ran to his room. He stripped down to his Yoda underwear and fished in the closet. 2 minutes later, he snuck back into the living room wearing his skeleton costume from last Halloween. He crept up behind his dad, who was cueing the movie. But David Rittermeier was too clever for that. He spun around at the last moment and bared fang teeth torn from paper plates, drawing a yip of surprise and a cry of, "No fair!" Daddy kicked off his Reeboks, plopped his smelly gym socks on the coffee table, another thing that Mom would hate, and killed the lights. The scary intro music began. The screen showed the silhouette of a boy, about Buddy's age. His shadow was a long, creepy cross. The Antichrist, the son of the devil. Born of a jackal on a night of astrological portent, destined to bring about the end times and the final battle of good versus evil. Buddy sipped sun-kissed and scooted up next to his dad. As the movie got scarier, he slipped an arm through his father's and cupped his big bicep. Buddy could feel his father's pulse. Dads get scared, too. They flinched together, shouted together, pointed at the screen and covered their faces together. Buddy pressed his eyes to Daddy's shoulder just before the on-screen maid shouted, "It's all for you, Damien!" and dove from the roof, hanging herself. Buddy knew which parts he was old enough to watch and which parts he wasn't. He trusted his dad to let him know when to look again. Occasionally, his dad tricked him into peeking too soon, but that was part of the fun. They kicked their feet at the screen and shouted, "Look up! Look up, oh idiot! Don't get yourself killed!" At the climax, the hero of the movie, Mr. Thorne, discovered a birthmark of 3 sixes on his son's head and dragged the little Antichrist to the altar of the church determined to spear his son with holy daggers and end evil forever. After it was over, the Rittermeier men sat silently through the credits. David put an arm around his son and ran his fingers through Buddy's hair. He wasn't searching for devil marks. He knew there weren't any. And Buddy was certain there were no daggers in his father's hand, either. Those things were just make-believe. Real fathers and sons don't do bad things to each other. They were queuing up Omen 2 when the power went out.
No,
Buddy whined.
Not on movie night.
Daddy went to the window. It's the whole block. Sorry, Damien. How about, scary blackout. Go get the Ouija board out of the guest room closet.
Cool.
And candles. Buddy found the Ouija board, hidden under old clothes. When he shut the sliding door again, the sight of a monster startled him, and he let out an involuntary,
huh,
sound. It was his own skeleton-bodied reflection in the mirrored closet door. He stared at it. He liked the effect of moonlight on his cheeks. Spectral, haunted, his eyes big and white. He clacked his teeth at himself, picturing his own grinning skull under his child's flesh, and gave an evil laugh. He was answered by a scream. A woman's scream. High-pitched and far away. One of the neighbors? Buddy dropped the Ouija board into a patch of moonlight and sat with it.
What's going on?
He whispered, his fingers on the heart-shaped wood planchette.